The Guardian.
Support for this podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand, or portfolio so easy, it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
The Unseen stalks today's podcast, where we're exploring hidden zones, internal and external, both fictional and unsettlingly, undeniably real. We'll be putting our inner selves under the spotlight with literature professor and practicing psychoanalyst Josh Cohen. But first, we travel to the doomed island of Mancro with the novelist Nick Harkaway to spin a story of fatherhood and shadows. He joins us to talk about his latest novel, Tiger Man, which imagines how, with environmental disaster waiting in the wings, the waters around the island have become a grey area where governments and corporations can conduct awkward business. He began by reading a passage from the novel which explores how his fictional island has become a place beyond legality which can only be glimpsed out of the corner of the eye.
The town and the port spread out below him, the invisible ships surprisingly close to the land. He felt his eyes flick away. Everyone found ways not to see what was in the bays. The fleet could have painted itself pink or burned to the waterline and no one would have remarked upon it. People saw the harbour and the horizon and nothing in between. Even the fishermen who went out and zipped in between the big vessels, selling fresh fish and crab, and the traders on junk boats who bought and sold DVDs and Coca-Cola and fresh meat and anything else they could lay their hands on, even they had a strange amnesia about which ships they visited. It wasn't feigned. It was a habit so totally ingrained as to have become part of reality. The enormous ships were a fact of life, and it was a fact that you couldn't see them. As with everything else, the boy was an exception. He bartered with the ship captains, argued with them loudly and crudely, demanded and received favours, tours, t-shirts and team hats. He had a Delta Force hat and a Real Madrid jacket, and a signed copy of something called Transmetropolitan, which the sergeant understood by the jubilation it had entailed to be a major coup. The boy had won them at dice or paid for them with gossip or simply asked for and received them. It seemed the captains admired his cheek, or maybe they were just desperately grateful for someone who acknowledged their existence. It didn't matter how tough you were, how psychologically motivated. It hurt to be invisible, even if that was the whole point. Like Diego Garcia of Rendition Infamy, Mancro had been found new uses by democratic governments wishing to avoid the consequences of their own inconvenient liberties, and by corporations seeking relief from the onerous duties of civilization. The border on the map had been softened and in places entirely cut away, so that a strange zone of legal limbo was created between the breakers and the 3-mile limit. In this maritime twilight, it was often hard to tell where nations ended and other entities began, where corporate activity shaded into organized crime, spying into a trade in unlawful commodities. Clustered across the cupped hands lay a mass of unaffiliated shipping, prisons for deniable detainees and hospitals for unethical procedures, data havens, grey banks, untaxed subsidiaries, floating harems and forced labour factories, auction houses for contraband goods, torture facilities for hire. So long as it never touched the shore, the business of the fleet was invisible. When the storms came in above the southern mountains, the ships drew apart from one another so that covert prows didn't gouge holes in unacknowledged hulls, so that secret masts didn't scythe across false flag decks. When the weather abated, they huddled so they could share cable television connections to the land and shout news to one another from deck to deck. American intelligence officers and their corporate side cousins traded Sara Lee brownies with Poles for vodka and Frenchmen for cigarettes. Brits gave up Hument and Lapsang Souchong and bought red wine and fresh milk and sometimes played cricket on a long, lean supertanker moored forever at the northernmost limit of the zone. And all of them traded snippets of information to the Mafia and the Triads in exchange for occasional housekeeping jobs, ex-gratia hookers and something to read. And the crooks were good for vanishings when an interrogation grew heated and a subject expired from his own ignorance. On other deployments, the sergeant had occasionally seen that sort of thing written up by contractors as self-injurious passive psychological attack culminating in asset compromise. But here, on the ships of the Black Fleet, those terms of art were unnecessary. So long as the fleet kept its activities to the waters of Mancro, no reports were ever written. Intelligence was sourceless, all analysis was done on site, and only the pure information ever emerged. The rule of law within the territory of Western democracies was preserved, and the conscience of ministers was notionally clean. Mancro was a tapestry of questions unasked because the answers were obvious. It had been going on for so long now that, at least to a global press whose owners sipped Chardonnay with prime ministers, it was no longer distressing.
So where did your doomed island of Mancro come from? Where did it all start?
Oh, it started in lots of places. I mean, it was a general sense, first of all, of environmental degradation. And this idea of the sacrifice zone of an island so polluted that it has to be destroyed. Sacrifice zones have been proposed. It's a real thing. And then, obviously, also, at the time, I had in my head this thing of Diego Garcia, which had just been in the news. David Miliband was summoned to account for unfortunately incorrect statements in the House of Commons. Not his, I believe. I think it was Jack Straw who was mistaken. And it is unkindly alleged at the moment in this as publication of this book happened, I was delighted to find it was unkindly alleged that there's been more going on at Diego Garcia than we've been told. That the putative American Senate report allegedly has a great deal to say about Diego Garcia and what's been going on there. So it's very interesting as a moment. Diego Garcia was the model, I suppose, for Mancra, and environmental degradation was part of the other part. Creativity for me is very often about collision of different things, so that was part of the collision that created the island.
And there's all the other elements as well. There's a mysterious boy, there's a sergeant who's been placed on some sort of furlough, there's a superhero as well.
Yeah, now it's very interesting. Is he a superhero? Because he has no powers. He doesn't even have the power that Batman has of being monstrously rich. He's just a bloke. I wanted to do a story about someone who, you know, fully aware of comic books in the world, nonetheless sort of finds himself in a situation where weirdly that is the most sane solution to the problem that he has. And so that's kind of what goes on. So is he a superhero? Well, yes, because if you work on it, if you give a completely mountainous task, a bad enough situation, to a naked person in a desert, you can turn that person into a superhero so long as they have the will to overcome this impossible problem. So, yeah, so it's a superhero story in that sense.
You say that Manco's anomalous state has been going on for so long that it was no longer distressing to the global press who'd been sipping their Chardonnay. You also say that the
owners sipping their Chardonnay. I'm not having a beef with journalists here.
You also say that the West just should have had a better bloody plan in the first place before invading it. Is this a book born out of anger?
I do get a little bit cross. I remember a time growing up watching hero stories and spy thrillers and so on, where the way that you could tell that someone was the bad guy was that they waterboarded someone. That was a marker that people would use. If you watch early Stallone movies and so on, someone gets waterboarded, that means the person doing it is a baddie. And that somehow disappeared. And suddenly that became something that reasonable people could do. And it's ridiculous and monstrous. Let's say it out loud, waterboarding is torture and it is illegal. So, you know, that is an extraordinary situation to have achieved. So I was angry, I am angry, and I think we should all be angry. And yes, I mean, the other thing, the flip side of that, is that we have a habit, we've developed a habit in the post-Cold War world of doing humanitarian intervention with a bad plan or no plan, no idea what we're going to do later, and we spend the lives of people, both in our armed forces and in the countries where we intervene, as if they were nothing. And they are, they're something, and that should be acknowledged, and it should be something that we take much more seriously than we do.
It could be that this is the first anti-capitalist climate change novel with a mass market readership. Was that actually what you're going for?
That would be awesome. That would be so great. I think I'd be really lucky to achieve that. And it's not so much anti as pro. It's pro people and about the things that actually matter, not the stuff that people talk up. You know, we can all put our hands in what matters. It's not difficult. What's extraordinary is how often we get sold a pup and be like, oh, this is terribly important. No, it isn't. No, it's not. You know, and I'm up in arms about the trade treaty that's being considered at the moment, which will give corporations the right to challenge national governments if their laws are too restrictive. You know, it drives me nuts. Why on earth is that important? It's not important. Historically, those treaties have resulted in a loss of jobs. We're being told it will create jobs. It's madness. But, you know, we're being sold it as this great job creation thing that will save us all. And later, when it doesn't, we'll look back and we'll go, oh, no, that damaged all the things we actually care about. That's awful.
There's this... amazing trick by which we seem to look the other way.
Yeah, there's a lot of looking the other way. There's also, we get professionally conned. I'm a writer, I tell lies for a living in a sense. You know, they're supposed to be lies that are somehow true, but they are fictions. And I see the rhythm of fiction being used in politics, and it drives me mad. You know, and I think it would be nice to have a political class who, for some extraordinary reason, felt an allegiance to the truth.
Your boy is not only a comics fan, but also deeply concerned about narrative propriety, about exactly that, about styles of realisms even. Were you working through some of these concerns through the book?
I think the thing that he's concerned about is this thing of, you know, the right outcome. I mean, he has also, because, you know, in the way that teenage boys become very didactic, or at least I did, and a lot of my friends did, very didactic about, you know, the way things should work, appropriate structures, appropriate social hierarchies, taxonomies are very important. So he has all that, and he applies that. He's massively bright. He's awe-inspiringly bright. But I find that children are. My children terrify me with their intelligence. My three-year-old daughter turned around to me the other day and said, "Is that a symbiotic relationship?" And I was just like, wow. And she went, "Or is it commensalism?" Because she's got this, there's this book by the Octonauts, this kind of children's thing about being under the sea and sort of rescuing animals. And commensalism is explained in the Octonauts in words of one syllable except for commensalism. And she's dishing it out to me. And I have to go and look up commensal now. I was just like, what does that mean? And she explained it to me and she was exactly right. Children are amazingly intelligent. Teenagers are brighter than all of us. Something we should bear in mind when we refuse to let them vote.
But it's you put your finger on a bit of a missing part of the literary conversation there, because we find it very difficult to talk about endings. We don't want to spoiler things. But nevertheless, when we're at these events at a festival, or when we're talking in an interview, we don't want to get to the nitty gritty of, you know, the fates that are dished out. But when you've read a book, the same book as a friend of yours, that's one of the most important things.
Yeah. Did you like the ending? Did it come off for you? Well, yeah, because that's the question. You know, that's the key question: is has the author made good on the bid they made in the opening pages? You know, on the reason that you bought the book in the first place. We were talking about this the other day at Worldcon, talking about, you know, you have to honour the bid, and I think you do have to do that. My God, you have to do that. But at the same time, there's a sort of subtext. You have to stretch people and make them go somewhere they didn't expect to go. And if you can honour the bid in a way they don't see coming, you know, that's extreme double victory. That's what you want.
I'm wondering if literary fiction in particular has a problem with endings, in that it's very, very difficult to think of a literary novel the past few years that manages to end with something that's positive, that's happy.
Yeah, there's a canonisation of sadness in literary culture, which I think is probably owed to Anna Karenina, this notion that that basically unhappy families are diverse and exciting and happy families are tediously the same, which is nonsense, but very Russian. And it's brilliantly written, so of course it's incredibly persuasive. And I don't think it's true. I think joy can be and is as absolutely as profound as sorrow. The thing about joy is it doesn't spend a lot of time talking about itself because it doesn't need to, whereas sorrow needs to discuss itself, look at itself, and be acknowledged, and that's how it perpetuates itself.
What about humour as well? There's a massive mistrust of humour in contemporary literary culture. But I mean, you may be kind of setting the world to rights here, but you're not afraid of a gag, are you?
No, I love a gag. But that's okay. There are two things about that. The first thing is just in general, humour and satire, but not just satire, so just straightforward humour, are very much part of setting the world to rights. I was watching some stuff from Ferguson, Missouri this morning, and it turns out that one of the things that's happening is that Thomas the Tank Engine is travelling through Ferguson playing soul music. That's one of the best responses I've seen to what is an extraordinary and terrifying situation. And more power to whoever's doing that. But also, we have a tradition in this country of extraordinarily humorous writing that's trenchant. You know, we have Evelyn Waugh, which is bitterly funny, and we have Douglas Adams, who was extraordinarily funny but also terribly angry. And we have people like Terry Pratchett who are writing who are hilarious and savagely funny about things. And because they're humorous, they tend to get sort of shunted to one side. But they shouldn't be. You know, those are the people who are making the gags about... I mean, first they ignore you, then they laugh at you, and then you win. You know, that's the gig.
It could only be a Nick Harkaway novel. I mean, with this kind of slightly...
I like to think so.
You've got a Japanese exobiologist who's brewing her own whiskey and is looking forward to dancing the funky chicken. I mean, do you relish these moments?
I relish them. This is partly about the real again. We talked about sort of literary culture having a slight rejection of happy endings, or, you know, and a fear of joy in a way. And the other thing I think is there's a kind of, if it was filmmaking, it would be dogma. You know, there's a kind of, you must not put makeup on your characters. You have to display them in their kind of warts and all, and they have to be disappointed and sad and filled with regret and so on, because that's profound. And it's not. And it's also because that's real. You know, that is quote-unquote real. And a lot of people are unhappy in the world. But the thing is, the world is also full of extraordinarily joyful people, even in the most appalling situations. And extraordinarily eccentric people, even where they should be, or you might expect them to be, very kind of tied down and ordinary. And I like the fact that the world is also burlesque, is also sometimes defiantly burlesque, and wants to be funny and humorous in the face, sometimes in the face of absolute horror.
You said this is your most personal novel yet, in some senses. But isn't it the job of the novelist to make stuff up?
It absolutely is. I always get very cranky about that whole write what you know thing, because, of course, it doesn't mean write only about your own life. It means write about the things that are in your heart that you know emotionally. It means write about the things that you know, you know, as styles, as whatever. So you can go and write a detective story even if you've never been murdered. You know, that's fine. One would hope.
It'd be hard to do it if you had been.
Well, again, some detective stories take that. I mean, you know, we've had the narrator as the victim. Anyway, look, the thing is, it is obviously the most personal story I've written because it's about being a dad, and I was becoming a dad during the writing of this book. You know, I broke off to edit another book and to write a non-fiction book and so on, and then I came back to the manuscript when I was a dad for the second time, you know, and wrote it again. So it's about the overwhelming, turbulent thing that is becoming a dad. But at the same time, obviously, it's also about geopolitics and superheroes and whatever, and lots of other things that I care about. But in the end, the reason that this book works, I think, is because it's about being a dad, and it's got a strong emotional heart.
The previous novel, Angel Maker, is full of invention. It's great fun. It's a roller coaster ride. But here, I feel it's kind of, to me, reading it, it feels like it's kind of stepped up a gear. Is that how it feels to you?
I think maybe. I was very, very careful because the sergeant, the central character, is not somebody who's into a big flourish of words. He's very much an emotional creature. I was very careful to keep the tone of the book all the time, or almost all the time, in a very kind of tight, closed, simple emotional register. Not because he's a foolish man, he's a very bright man, but he's not someone who's going to talk about intractability. He's going to say, this can't be done. You know, and that's the language that he uses, and that's how he thinks. And I wanted that. And I think in a way that gives you a freedom to kind of, you know, to show a greater emotional side and so on. But I mean, my goodness, if I wasn't getting better at this over the course of each book, that would be a problem. You know, you've got to improve as you go along, and you've got to challenge yourself. My next book terrifies me because it's got all this kind of stuff that I've got to deal with, and different central characters, and there's issues of identity and so on. And it's absolutely gobsmacking. I can't believe I've taken it on. But you have to, because otherwise you don't grow.
That was my next question there. What's next? And there it is. You've given it.
Yeah. Semiotics, alchemy, code breaking, you know, all that stuff.
the whole potato.
But also, you know, an attempt to do something that will emotionally and intellectually turn your head inside out. But I've got to get it right, because otherwise it's just a silly story.
The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace. When you need to know what's in the news, you turn to The Guardian. When you want to create something newsworthy, you turn to Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it easy to create your own professional website for your small business, online store, professional portfolio, or blog. Getting started takes only seconds. Just go to squarespace.com, and to support this podcast, use the offer code GUARDIAN to take 10% off.
Professor Josh Cohen investigates hidden spaces of a different kind in The Private Life, in which he argues our sense of self is increasingly under threat. He began by explaining what he means by our contemporary culture of intrusion, and how telephoto lenses and social media are putting the richness of inexperience under pressure.
I mean, first of all, the ways in which the external culture intrudes into our internal lives in various ways. We have gross intrusions, some of which are forced. For example, tabloid culture, the paparazzi telephoto lens kind of intrusion. And then we have more complicit forms of intrusion, such as reality TV and, of course, social media, and a culture of social media which encourages the pervasive and perpetual display of personal intimacies from sex to grief.
Not only always on, but also on a kind of global scale. You're comparing yourself with not only the people you know around you live in the same street, but the whole world.
Yes, that's right. So there's a kind of constant internal pressure on the self to imagine themselves in a very externalized way in relation to everyone else. And so what happens in that context, I think, is that we lose contact with the sources of the self, with the sources of our own creativity, what one psychoanalyst calls our own idiom, that is, our own kind of personal style of speaking, of thinking, of being oneself, because the only metric that we have for thinking about ourselves comes from the outside, comes from whatever everyone else is doing.
The privacy that you think is at risk is much more widely drawn than our usual conception of the bourgeois privacy, the kind of basic facts about who did what with whom or what you own. What do you mean by the stubborn remainder after all of those secrets have been revealed, the portion of the self which no lens can penetrate and no law can defend?
Well, we have a visible self and a visible life that we make available to other people. And that is what we own, that is what we do. Some of that we want to keep to ourselves, but it's still at some level external. So our bank details, or even the sort of factual details of our external lives, who we're sleeping with or who we're in some poisonous rivalry with, that's still something external, tangible, that one can talk about. Then there is a kind of more invisible life, the life of the imagination, but also the life of the unconscious, the life of our deepest and strangest impulses, what psychoanalysis calls the unconscious. And those aspects of ourselves, the imagination, the unconscious, are necessarily invisible. And so I would want to, in a way, in the way that Freud was always interested in expanding the way in which we use our terms, I'm wanting to expand our sense of privacy from the external privacy of what we do or what we own to the privacy of who we are.
And it's exactly this kind of inner life, the richness of this inner life, which is at stake.
Yeah, that's the basic premise of the book, that in a culture that places such a premium on maintaining and reinventing the external self and reinventing the self that we put on display and show to the world, the inner life gets impoverished. Now, to tweak it a little bit, it not only impoverishes the inner life, it also impoverishes public life or the external face that we show the world. Because if, in a way, the richness of our public face, the richness of the personality that we put out there, is actually intimately linked with how much contact we have with the inner self. And if we lose contact with that, if we construct a self entirely around an externalized model of what somebody else thinks, of how somebody else dresses, of how somebody else speaks, then that sense of a full self that is based on a kind of intimacy and interchange between the inside and the outside also disappears, or at least corrodes.
Is this a modern problem, which basically can be blamed on the modern media and indeed the internet?
I think in many ways it is, because it belongs to the context of modernity. It belongs to an urban context in which many of us, anyway, most of the world lives in spaces in which we know far less people than we see. And so we are subject to our own gaze on other people and their gaze on us all of the time, constantly imagining who they are and what they think about us. And I think that that does exacerbate the kinds of internal pressures that we're talking about. But also, of course, it's a world which over the last 200-300 years has seen a progressive explosion of technologies, of media, that are ways through which we perceive ourselves and perceive others. So in that sense, yes, our sense of the private, the public self and their relationship is very much a modern condition, a modern predicament.
You're not suggesting that having a public face is a problem, that it's new to have a public face, it's just that the balance has gone wrong.
That's it, yeah. I think not only am I not suggesting it's a problem, on the contrary, the public face is an essential dimension of the self. And I talk in the book about the British psychoanalyst D.W. Winnicott and his notion that a public self, an external self, actually provides a protective carapace for the inner self. The inner self can't do without a public face because it can't be exposed in its raw form. There is something, Winnicott says, silent and uncommunicative about the inner self. It's the sort of the source of the imagination. It's the source of our creativity, but it needs kind of protection. It needs a kind of darkness. And so a public face provides that for the inner self. As we say, it's a matter of maintaining that public self, maintaining contact with the inner self, which is actually its source.
Do you think there are analogues in a kind of wider sense, in the social sphere, in our 24-hour news media culture, for this withering of the internal reality that's actually at stake?
I would say that tabloid culture, reality TV culture, is the social analogue, in the sense that it, of course, involves individual selves entering public space, entering the space of visibility, and externalising themselves, often in a very radical way. But it also has an effect on social cultural discourse itself. It creates an atmosphere in which priority is given to the external, to the surfaces of life. So if we think about heat culture, if we think about Big Brother, the emphasis in those contexts is very much on creating ideals, models of the self, which have been generated by a very kind of alien, in a way quite abstract, because cut off from any kind of individual subjective experience, versions of the self.
These effects aren't only cultural, they're also kind of political, real world things. I mean, this kind of shiny layer of noise and chatter leaves space for things to go on underneath, so if corporations can present a public face and then do something very different. I mean, I'm thinking the dodgy dossier for Iraq, yeah, for example. This is all part of the same wider sociological problem.
I think so, yeah. I mean, when you were talking about corporations, I was thinking in a way of a much more trivial instance, which is the sort of increasingly pervasive strain of chumminess that's entered into corporate language. You know, you have these actually quite large food corporations that all seem to want to address you as their great friend. You know, they sort of say hello mate on the back of a cereal box or something, and they use this sort of very sentimentalized, cuddly language. Now, in a way, that does carry across to something like a political context, where political decisions are always framed in a very sort of consumer-friendly language. Decisions are made because they have the best interests of you in mind. There's something sort of tacitly paternalistic about this kind of chumminess. You know, in some ways, Cameron is a fascinating phenomenon in this regard, because he's brought a kind of apolitical, neutral chumminess into political discourse that I think is very much part of this externalization of culture, the sense, and also I think the infantilization of culture, the way in which we're not allowed to be grown-up thinking selves who are interested and curious in our own decisions, in our own impulses.
But do you think there's something more sinister going on? Do you think that it's not that we're not so much permitted to be grown-up, it's that it's easier for those who are trying to act in this hidden way if we don't pay attention?
Well, sinister, yes, although I wouldn't say that there's anything intentional about it. I think that it's an impersonal effect, and it's an effect of culture itself. I don't think there's anything consciously Machiavellian about Cameron or about any of the major political parties. It's just that they've been sucked into a kind of political logic, into a cultural logic, which is so externalizing, so keyed into a particular kind of consumerist language of consensus, of sort of wanting to please everybody all of the time. You know, it does make me a little nostalgic for, you know, the 80s in which I grew up, in which whatever was happening, whatever the perniciousness of the political culture of the time, my God, there was a sense that things were at stake. In an increasingly externalized political culture, that's what's being lost, I think, the sense that something is at stake, which I think speaks to the apathy of the times.
Josh Cohen's The Private Life is published by Granta, while William Heinemann publishes Nick Harkaway's Tiger Man in the UK. You can explore more literary secrets if you subscribe on iTunes, follow us on SoundCloud, or join in the discussion on the Guardian Books website. Just search for Guardian Books Podcast. From me, Richard Lee, and our producer, Ian Chambers, see you next time.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace.
When you need to know what's in the news, you turn to The Guardian. When you want to create something newsworthy, you turn to Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it easy to create your own professional website for your small business, online store, professional portfolio, or blog. Getting started takes only seconds. Just go to squarespace.com, and to support this podcast, use the offer code GUARDIAN to take 10% off.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.